You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 16th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ted Miller, author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, The John Birch Society, and The Revolution of American Conservatism. Meanwhile, congratulations to Joe Manchin, who has nearly blown up the Build Back Better bill entirely. That's what he wanted all along. Suddenly, he's against the one-year child tax credit extension. Without an extension, 10 million children will fall back into poverty, and the potentially last check was sent out yesterday.
Don't want entitlement, folks.
Nope. A new study presented to the World Health Organization yesterday suggests that vaccines still provide strong protection against Omicron. While studies have, the booster specifically. While studies have been showing that the variant can evade antibodies, there are encouraging signs about the T cells, another kind of immune cell in vaccinated people, providing a second line of defense. This comes as COVID cases are skyrocketing. I know firsthand. The UK set a daily record in cases, and cases in the US are on the rise again as well. The tally death toll in the U.S. has passed 800,000. President Biden toured Kentucky yesterday after devastating storms killed at least 75 and left 1,000 people homeless. This comes as unprecedented storms have hit much of the central U.S. as well. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected a call to ban lawmakers and their spouses from trading stocks. I'm sure that her past history has nothing to do with that. More on that after headlines. And lastly, revolutionary feminist writer, capitalist critic, and social justice advocate Bell Hooks has passed away at 69 years old. She helped popularize the concept of intersectional feminism and broaden the scope of feminist thinking. Rest in power, Bell Hooks. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out, as he is every Thursday, but we have a great show for you. I know Sam touched on it, but my absence was very unexpected on Tuesday. Actually, I was in the office, got a text at around 11:30 a.m. Eastern, half hour before the show starts. My friend says, who I was with on Saturday, I think I have COVID. And I, like, slowly put on my mask, and I was just like...
All of a sudden, we hear Emma speaking, and I look up, and she has her mask on. It's like, I wonder what news she just got.
So, I kind of had a bit of a panic attack, I shouldn't say that, but I was like, oh my god, I really don't want, I don't want anybody here to get sick, obviously, and I've tried to be pretty careful, but I think, you know, maybe I've been going to more... friend hangouts. Like, I've been a little looser with this, and this has been a reality check for me. I got a rapid negative and then a PCR negative. My boyfriend also rapid negative, PCR negative. And it seems like the person who I was with a few other friends, didn't start shedding virus until after, because no one else seems to have gotten it, which is really good news. But that's why I was unexpectedly out of the studio on Tuesday and Wednesday. Just wanted to explain that to everybody, but I am back. And I'm here to rip on Nancy Pelosi. That's kind of what I'm, you know, that's the way to start the day off on the right foot. So Nancy Pelosi, she made a strong statement yesterday. You know, she girl bossed all over this bitch. She was outraged. She was taking the parties to task that need to be taken to task.
She was leaning in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Sandberg would be so proud, because was she directing her ire at Joe Manchin, who's trying to kill the entire Biden agenda and throw 10 million United States children into poverty? Was it because Pelosi still can't get over how furious she was about Lauren Boebert launching Islamophobic attacks on Ilhan Omar? Do we have an update on any censure vote, by the way? Doesn't seem like leadership's that interested in that. But wait, let me look at my notes. Sam does that better than me. This can't be right. She was actually outraged because some members of her caucus want to ban lawmakers from engaging in what is essentially insider trading? Here she is, answering a question about that.
Madam Speaker, Insider just completed a five-month investigation finding that 49 members of Congress and 182 senior congressional staffers have violated the STOP Act, the insider trading law. I'm wondering if you have any reaction to that, and secondly, should members of Congress and their spouses be banned from trading individual stocks while serving in Congress?
No, I don't know to the second one. We have a responsibility to report in the stock. On a stock, but I'm not familiar with that 5 month review. But if the people aren't reporting, they should be. Because this is a free market, and people, we are a free market economy. They should be able to participate in that.
It's interesting. I mean, maybe the spouse thing is what got her, because there are people on Reddit and on TikTok. Literally, Pelosi's so famous for this. There are people who follow her husband, Paul Pelosi, and his stock trading, because people, there's common knowledge that what he's doing might make them money. And it makes sense. Pull up this article, if you could, Bradley, from July of this year. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband cashed in on big tech just as Congress was set to pounce. Can scroll down a little bit. No, it's okay. This week before the House Judiciary Committee voted on reining in big tech, Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband exercised a bullish bet on Google parent Alphabet, a timely transaction that netted him $5.3 million. The antitrust bill was advanced as a push by the government to curb the unregulated power of big tech firms Google, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook. It was the final part of a six-part package called Ending Platform Monopolies Act, aimed at restricting how big tech companies offer their products to ensure they don't use their size to dominate the market. I guess the details aren't that fully important there. That's all we really need to see. But this is not this has happened before with Pelosi's husband as well.
I mean, this is classic free market stuff. Like, how can the market allocate capital efficiently if, like, what's his name? Richard Burr can't unload a whole bunch of hospitality stock right before a pandemic, the full scale of a pandemic is known. Like, that's market 101.
And yeah, it's interesting too how are Pelosi and the Democrats able to deploy an attack effectively on that front when, say, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff are running in the Georgia Senate elections, and it was Kelly Loeffler, I believe, who was engaging in brazen insider trading when the Democrats have control of both chambers? Nancy Pelosi is not interested in doing anything to stop that because, as I mentioned, just this past year, one move by her husband was able to net her and him $5.3 million. And it's interesting because regular citizens who are made aware of non-public information prior to a trade, people go to jail for insider trading. I mean, everybody knows that's what Martha Stewart went to jail for. They are apparently not engaging in the free market in a way that is free. But members of Congress also have access to information prior to trades happening, and they're doing the same exact thing, except it's just sanctioned. The difference is because they make the laws. Martha Stewart or the trader who, I'm not going to, you know, cry a river for people who get convicted of insider trading, but the hypocrisy makes sense. Like,
should have been a lot more heads rolling besides Martha Stewart.
Right. Right. There are people on Wall Street who engage in this all the time. I think insider trading should be enforced with the law much more aggressively, and that applies to members of Congress who are just doing it with a different flavor.
I'd frankly be much more aggressive with outsider trading as well, but that's a little bit beside the point.
Yeah, there. Right, exactly. I mean, I agree. Passive wealth.
Yeah, exactly.
Increases,
and like this on top of like the BBB failure and the student loan stuff. It's like, particularly the squad, like they can't be sharing money with these people. Small donor money. Like some kind of line has to be crossed here, because this is absolutely despicable. The jag that the Democrats are on right now.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I saw Andrew Lawrence, I mean, we'll move into a break in a second, but just tweeted a video of a guy continuously punching himself in the nuts and compared that to what the Democrats are like in power. Pretty accurate. All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Ted Miller to talk about the John Birch Society and more. We are back, and we are joined right now by Ted Miller, author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, The John Birch Society, and The Revolution of American Conservatism. Welcome to the show, Ted. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be here on Majority Report.
Well, I'm excited to talk about this with you because I love any way that we can historicize the current dynamics that we are all experiencing in the present day. I mean, that it sounds a little redundant, but it's true. I mean, the current way that American conservatism exists, I mean, you hear a lot of people go, what happened to the Republican Party? What happened to American conservatism? I mean, there used to be reasonable Republicans. I'd quibble with that, but like that's largely a reference to the Trump takeover, the kind of post-truthism that we're living in with the Republicans, the QAnon types, and your book shows that you can really trace that back to the John Birch Society and Robert Welch. So I guess let's start with the John Birch Society's founder, Robert Welch. Welch, who was he, and how did he get his start?
Robert Welch was born in 1899, and he was a candy manufacturer, and he created such childhood favorites as the Sugar Daddies and the Junior Mints. He would do very well in candy and make a significant amount of money, but he decided that he wanted to focus on educating Americans about the threat of communism. And he was very concerned about this, and he believed that, in particular, that the current president at the time, Dwight David Eisenhower, was a communist. And he started an organization called the John Birch Society in 1958. Which continues to this day, and it was an organization comprised of businessmen. 11 members met at Margaret Dice's home in Indiana, and they basically were a conspiratorial organization that argued that Earl Warren ought to be impeached, that the United States should get out of the UN, that income taxes were too high. So it was an organization that was seen at the time as sort of the on the fringes, but over time, as you eloquently mentioned, it has been recent historians have looked at it, and we're reconsidering that this was an organization that was paramount to the rise of the conservative movement.
Yeah, and I mean, I laugh at the Eisenhower communist conspiracy just because I, you know enough about Eisenhower to make that it's so ridiculous. But I mean, that's not so far off from what we're seeing today. About there are secret allegiances in the deep state, and there are you could also maybe draw some lines to. I don't want to go down this road, but there were people that went a little hard with Trump as a Russian agent. That's a little bit different. That's from the left, but I don't want to get sidetracked on that. I mean, this kind of paranoia, it's the muscle memory is just still super relevant.
To suggest that Dwight Eisenhower was a communist, the man who defeated Hitler, the man who organized the D-Day invasion, the man who was responsible for passing legislation that was not communistic. I mean, we're talking about he was passing a minimum wage increase and a social security increase. It's not that communistic, as far as my opinion goes.
Yeah. So I guess let's start, and we can kind of go through the timeline of the origins of the John Birch Society, and then really, I guess, through the 60s and up to Reagan, if you'd like. I mean,
sure.
How much of the foundation of the John Birch Society and Robert Welch's radicalization came from a knee-jerk response to FDR's politics and the New Deal?
That's a very interesting question, and I think that the his conspiratorial viewpoint, as I mentioned in the book, has many dimensions to it. He's a boy who's born in the South during a time when there was a lot of discussion of the Lost Cause, and there was a discussion of his grandparents, and his parents would talk about how the North was going to end slavery. The Welches came from a family in which there were participants in the Confederate side of the Civil War who. And they did fear losing their slaves, and they feared an encroaching, monopolizing Eastern establishment that was going to wreak havoc on their farm system. They were farmers. There's also other aspects of Welch's conspiratorial viewpoint that are influenced, such as the fact that he was a candy man, and there was no patent there's no patent even today on making candy. And so candy men tend to be suspicious, to put it euphemistically. And if you take a look at the Mars family, they are very concerned that others would, you know, come up with discover the secret ingredient to the next breakthrough, or the everlasting gobstopper.
I mean, that's yeah. Go on.
And so, I mean, those are the things that are influencing Welch. Where he was coming from, his background, but the times in which he kind of was during his 40s. the Republicans were concerned about the loss of China. And Robert Welch became convinced that McCarthy was right. Joseph McCarthy was right that the Democrats had lost China, and the McCarthy went after Acheson, and he went after the Army of the United States, and Welch just took it to the next level. He went to after the head of the Army, Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine, too, when you I've never thought about the Candyman being a bit protectionist or whatever, but it makes sense when you have a baseline of paranoia about trying to keep what is yours, that those politics might blend into what we saw the John Birch Society become and Robert Welch, his politics.
In my research, I happened to walk through Cambridge, where there's a lot of where Welch had his company, and there's a lot of candy companies there. And the windows, you can't see through the windows because I think that the CEOs have made sure that they don't want to be they don't want the opposition to know what's going on behind those windows. So there is something in the – this is something for a future PhD dissertation maybe to right. explore the Candyman's suspicion.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess before I do want to get to Eisenhower, but I want to talk about how his politics evolved during the Truman administration. So he seemed to feel like you were either surrendering to communists or you were a communist or you were in my group. Truman, he felt, was, I guess, not weak in the face of communism. Tell us a little bit about how his politics came to be during the Truman administration.
Well, it's very much influenced by many middle-class liberals at the tail end of World War II. America really believed that it could do anything. We could, as JFK said, bear any burden, support any foe, to ensure the survival of and the success of liberty. There was an unlimited ability to do things. And he thought, Welch basically came to the conclusion that, okay, we oppose China going communist in 1949, right? We won World War II. So why did it go communist? Well, instead of arguing that it was mistakes or maybe the Chinese people decided to go in that particular direction, Welch had a different analysis. He just came to the conclusion that they wanted to be democratic. But they not only wanted to be democratic, they should be democratic, and it's our fault that they're not democratic. So that's what he and conspiracy was involved in.
How did he come to the conclusion that the people of China were just like unwillingly being taken over by communism, and that it was Truman's fault for not stopping that surge?
I think it's a basic assumption that everybody and a really important point that a lot of Americans had this belief in American exceptionalism, that if people did not want to be democratic, there was something wrong with them. And Welch basically said that if they are not democratic, it's our fault, and it's not through mistakes, it's through nefarious treason.
And what was Welch's understanding of or definition of democracy?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, Welch was Welch had a generally negative view of democracy as we understand it. I mean, we today. We're in a wonderful time where African Americans can vote because of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We're in a time where women can vote because of the 1920 passage of a constitutional amendment. And we have a lot of folks who are following that trend, and they're participating in elections. But Welch really believed that we're a republic, not a democracy. We're a country that elects individuals who will, who we give certain rights to in order that we may, in order that we may live in this, well, if you go back to Hobbes, I guess we don't live in a state of nature. Welch is basically saying that this is the way it is. We should follow our elected representatives, and democracy in the streets is not the answer.
It's just interesting, but the ideal must be applied internationally as like an extension of American greatness and thus anti-communist greatness. And it's odd to it's maybe a fruitless endeavor to point out all the contradictions, but it's fascinating to me how someone's psychology can be that inconsistent.
Well, it's the psychology of a lot of Americans after World War II, because it was anything was possible. There was this confidence that we can't even fathom today when we speak about it, when we think about what they had done, and it was this unbelievable belief that anything was possible, and like JFK would believe it. JFK believed that we can go to the moon in 8 years. You know, that that we're America. We can do this, and I think that Welch falls under that category.
Right.
I mean, completely ideologically different, but. Really believes that there's something the matter if everybody's not democratic.
Let's turn then to, I guess, the election that brought Eisenhower to power, because Eisenhower clearly wasn't Welch's type of guy. I mean, or maybe preferred type of Republican candidate the way he was campaigning, I would imagine. Like, one, where was Welch in his political influence at the time of the election where Eisenhower won? And two, he was not that was not his primary choice in the Republican Party.
No, he was a Taft supporter, and he actually campaigned actively with Taft, driving around Cambridge with Taft, and he tried a corny joke on Taft, and Taft just looked at him like, you know. That wasn't funny, and that's kind of how Taft was. But he saw things that were going on throughout the course of that election with Taft that bothered him. He saw the associates that Eisenhower was involved with, and he came to the conclusion that Eisenhower was participating with some individuals who were of the not the right disposition. They were of the far left. And he basically came to the conclusion that Eisenhower stole the election from Taft, and Taft would have made a great president, according to Welch. Welch was, despite the fact that he was from North Carolina and had come to the Massachusetts, he was more of a Midwestern Republican. You know, he believed in small business, and his candy business depended on the milk and the dairy products, of course, that would come from the Midwest. But there was something that really bothered him about that election. He believed that. Why he hated Earl Warren so much. He believed that a deal was made between Nixon and Eisenhower and Warren so that Warren would support Eisenhower's getting the delegation from in California in return for the appointment to Chief Justice. So Welch came to that conclusion. And so you see all these in the later John Birch Society, you see all these impeacher Warren signs on barns and cars and all across the land, really, on billboards.
And you can, I mean, again, to bring it to present day, stolen elections, backroom deals that elevate somebody who isn't rightfully supposed to be there. That is the this is where a lot of this groundwork was laid for this like modern conservatism, as you write in your book. And I want to like move into then the Eisenhower presidency, so we can get to the launch of the John Birch Society at the end of the 1950s. I mean, there was this, the Sputnik launch under Eisenhower. There were, you know, well, let me just ask that then. The Sputnik launch, how much did that freak Welch out? And how much did that kind of inform his conspiracy theory that Eisenhower was secretly a communist?
Oh, Welch didn't even think there was a Sputnik launch.
Oh.
He believed there was a it was launched by the Americans. He believed that the Russians did not have the capability technologically to launch a satellite into outer space, and concluded that, he said something to the effect that we don't believe that you have a space program, and there was no Sputnik, and you know, this is a non-issue.
Because they're Soviet and you can't possibly have technological success if you're not a capitalist society. Right.
It was just phony. It was, there was no, Sputnik didn't exist, you know, or Sputnik 2. It didn't happen.
Working backwards from the like American exceptionalist or capitalist conclusion, and then everything stems from that. That's how, you know, the thinking pattern is inversed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he continues that throughout. There's no real reason to be alarmed about the Cuban Missile Crisis, because they don't have the ability to launch missiles. You know, the book is a completely different world. If you want to have an introduction to American history from a completely different perspective, it's a great introduction. So it's a very interesting introduction to, it was interesting just seeing how somebody thought like that.
So, fascinating. Yeah. And let's then, I guess, take, let's go to the founding of the John Birch Society at the end of the 1950s, which also coincided with the rise of William F. Buckley and the founding of the National Review. My understanding is that Buckley was deeply associated with the John Birch Society, but publicly did not wanted there to be some distance, because there was a belief that there was a bit kooky. I guess that's kind of two questions in one, which is my MO. So I guess the founding of the John Birch Society, and then also if you could talk a little bit about Buckley.
Well, Buckley was tangled up in the John Birch Society in the beginning, because his funding from Roger Milliken came from the same funding, Buckley's funding came from the same funding that the John Birch Society came from. Willie Schlamm was a excellent editor of American Review. He was also in Buckley's National Review. American Opinion, excuse me, is Welch's magazine. But Willie Schlamm was the editor of, well, it was a writer in American Opinion. And he was also in National Review. And also Medford Evans wrote for both. So Buckley is very reluctant at first to take on this organization with so many ties. It's tough to cut out a cancer when what he sees as a cancer, this conspiratorial cancer, when in fact it's a really tight dynamic. He's trying to break free of it. And he ultimately comes to the conclusion that he has to. And he basically says that we need to put Robert Welch where he should be, in the editorial room, instead of serving as the president of the John Birch Society. And he condemns those who support the John Birch Society. He also encourages Barry Goldwater to do the same. And generally, there was this belief for this long time, because Buckley was a master chronicler of the conservative movement. He really was the person who said he wanted to protect it. And he wanted to say, I am the person who is going to say that this is how it happened. And for a while, he did a great job at it. And so Buckley presents this narrative that he completely ostracized Welch from the movement, when in fact, as I look back, as I went through my book, it's not the case that that Welch hung around for a long, long time, kind of like the fundamentalists in the 1930s after, in the 1920s after the monkey trial, with Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan. He changed his story. He came up with new issues, and Buckley never excommunicated him, and hence today.
Yeah, I mean, so Buckley was just kind of, I guess, sidelining him while still wanting to say two things at once, or to speak to two audiences at once, which often conservatives are really, really good at. I guess this is a good opportunity to also talk about what the John Birch Society was. I mean, at this point, how many chapters were they? How did they recruit members? What was the purpose of a lot of their project outside of, like, the adjacent publications that were promulgating these conspiracy theories?
Well, that's interesting, because it's primarily an educational organization. Some of the folks have said that Welch was an autocrat and a sort of a, they Mike Newbery in the early 1960s called him the Führer, but it really wasn't the case, because he couldn't control some of the members of the council. And like for people like Clarence Mannion, they wanted, Clarence Mannion was on the council of the John Birch Society and was a very prominent conservative, and also the former law school head of Notre Dame. But he basically comes to the conclusion that we should be focusing on electing candidates. And Welch basically says, no, you know, we're just an educational organization. We're not going to get involved in politics. So that's what it was. It was an organization where people could get together, men and women, would meet in chapters in their neighborhoods, and they would discuss the issues that were in the bulletin, and maybe they'd watch a film from John Birch, from Welch himself, where he'd talk about the communist conspiracy. They would read books together. They'd read books like something from Victor Lasky or Dan Smoot, who are these ultra-conservative writers. Even after this breakdown between the relationship, Welch is still saying, you should read Buckley's books. You should read William Kirk's books. So, you know, it was an organization that was primarily an educational organization that got dragged into these political issues because of Welch's conspiracism.
Well, I mean, it's education, I guess, for a purpose, right? It's a meant to, I mean, it reminds me sort of what we're experiencing right now with the anti-critical race theory push, where you can activate people on a grassroots level by energizing them, saying, well, the liberals, the left, communists in this instance, are an existential threat and they're changing your way of life. And here we can organize in your communities, and then it activates people politically.
That's a super point. I never thought of that that analogy. But that is, you know, that would be, you know, the type of thing, you know, it would be like, doesn't Earl Warren really upset you? Look at all the horrible things that Earl Warren has done. And, you know, look what he's done with the, I mean, that's what he's really going for when he's trying to impeach Earl Warren. You know, Welch would mention not only the Brown versus Board of Education decision, but he'd mention the fact that Warren passed other Supreme Court decisions that allowed that prohibited state legislatures to ask individuals about their political affinities. So you know, that's what he was driving at. Or you know, Welch would say there's been restrictions on your gun rights, or there is a war on Christmas going on. Isn't this something that should drive you to elect more conservative politicians? Yeah,
right.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
So
I included that in the book.
I mean, it's all good. It's in the discussion. Like, so, I mean, there clearly also was a precedent for a part of of the conservative movement that called prominent members of the Republican Party, party leaders, essentially traitors and, you know, people who were beholden to other interests. That's obviously something we're seeing too in the Republican Party today with the base. Like, how would Welch, I guess, feel about that legacy? Would that be something that he's proud of? I mean, and do you see those parallels that I pointed out today?
Well, Welch, he couldn't stand Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon was, to him, it was all about Richard Nixon. Welch had him. I mean, he was quite prescient on Richard Nixon. He was quite perspicacious. He understood where Nixon was heading, and he believed that Nixon was all about himself. And he saw him as even in the early 1950s, he saw Nixon as just promoting himself and a slippery politician and not committed to anything except Richard Nixon. And he would be one. Welch was very reluctant to attack politicians, but he made it very clear that he was not a fan of Richard Nixon, nor did Richard Nixon fit into his understanding of what a conservative should be.
So let's, I guess, move to the JFK and the presidency, and then there was a decline in John Birch Society membership. It seems like that coincided pretty well with JFK's presidency, but there was an uptick in conspiracy. Am I wrong about that?
Well, actually, it was JFK was great for the John Birch Society.
My bad. I'm got my dates mixed up. Go on.
No problem. Because what happened was when JFK became president, it was like there was a spike in membership to the John Birch Society. And then after the Goldwater loss, there was a downturn. So,
gotcha. Okay. So
no,
I guess let's talk about how they evolved during the JFK presidency, because afterwards with his assassination, we're also there seemed to be a greater understanding of, or people start to speculate the government is doing things that you may not know about, and there are public the public is largely hidden from some of the machinations that may be happening behind the scenes. Like, there's just a bit more of a, I don't know, a public awareness of legitimate conspiracy, I guess, which also then leads to illegitimate conspiracy theories. So I guess let's talk about the JFK presidency and what it did.
So obviously Welch was very unhappy with the Kennedy presidency, his support for civil rights. Welch believed the civil rights movement was a communist conspiracy. He also convinced that he actually was quite, again, quite prescient as far as understanding that the Castro was a communist. And he knew even by 1958 that he was a communist. And he thought that Kennedy's treatment, even despite the fact that Kennedy invaded the Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, Welch attacked, in fact, eviscerated JFK, for doing this, which didn't really make any sense because he had attempted to overthrow, it was the liberation policy that Republicans had dreamed of.
Right.
This has been something that was finally done, and, it was a little hypocritical there that it wasn't I point that out in the book that, this is finally, you're getting what you want, and it didn't, you should be a little more empathetic. but as the Kennedy presidency continues, there are other conservatives who get involved in this, and one of those conservatives is Dan Smoot, who's close with Welch. And Dan Smoot, he comes up with this idea that the Council on Foreign Relations, that it was an organization that was sort of a government within the government. And this really helps radicalize conspiratorial thinking, because what happens is this is a way that Welch moves beyond this kind of idea of that the communists are behind everything. And now he says it's the people inside the government. It's the deep state that's running the show. And this is something that we see today as well.
Yeah.
That's what came out during JFK's presidency.
Right. And these theories, they begin with kernels of truth. And then, of course, at least, especially on the right, they become unhinged. We're running out of time, so I do want to jump ahead to Ronald Reagan, because I know that that's a bit of a time jump, but it seems to me that his presidency is the ultimate John Birch Society presidency. Would you say that?
Yeah, and even I was thinking the other night there's plenty of examples that come to mind, but I was thinking about this, and when Kennedy was running for president, Reagan said, under the boyish lock of hair, it's the same old thing, Karl Marx. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, John Kennedy started the tax cut that you completed in 1981. And that's quite a jump. So even as early as 1960, Reagan is talking about this a different type of worldview that's from reality. So in 1976, Reagan, he runs against Ford, and in his campaign materials, he supports this anti-cancer quack treatment called Latrelle that was developed by a John Birch Society the person who took over for Robert Welch, Larry McDonald, and basically Reagan says this is something you should try, and the problem is it's killing people. It's a problem. So, and he also says that the Soviet Union is planning a potential first launch, and they're sending 20 million of their young people to an area of the Soviet Union to respond to that launch, so they can survive the launch. He said that Gerald Ford's assassination attempts were illegitimate. They were not legitimate that he made them. The list goes on and on. So, it's Reagan is a, especially between that period when he's no longer governor until the time he becomes president, and even after he becomes president, he's aping a lot of the things very subtly how Welch and the John Birch Society think.
And then it seems to me that he fuses that with he's speaking to evangelical base and merges these two, like a conspiratorial element or a anti-communist element with the evangelical base, and that's just the Republican base now.
The most surprising thing that came out of my book was the fact that Robert Welch was ahead of the Republican Party on abortion, in other words, opposing abortion, mm-hmm. head of the Republican Party on ERA, head of the Republican Party on social issues like sex education, head of the Republican Party on taxation. In fact, one of the Birchers, Lewis Euler, supported and was the leader of Proposition 13 that led to all the tax in Massachusetts. I live here in Massachusetts, and we still have the Proposition 2.5 as a result of Reagan's Proposition 13. But it resulted in Reagan's passage of the tax bill of 81 that dropped the taxes from 70% to 50%. So it's not just conspiracy. It's policy.
Right.
It's really the policy that Welch is instrumental in establishing. What he does is he establishes, Welch kind of realizes that the John Birch Society has been maimed as far as its name, and there are going to be fewer individuals joining it because of its reputation. So what he does is he establishes these ad hoc committees, and these are ad hoc committees that focus on one issue in particular, like taxation or the ERA or the or abortion, and this is how he gets through and really influences the Republican Party of Reagan. He, in a sense, builds the Reagan Revolution.
It's fascinating stuff. I really appreciate your time today. Ted Miller, his book is called, and I'm pulling it up in my notes right now, A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, The John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Thank you so much for your time today, Ted. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be on Majority Report.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Thanks so much. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour.
We'll be right back.
We are back. We are back. And we are probably just going to wrap up the first hour of the show and head into the fun half. We'll be taking your calls. We'll be reading your IMs, all that fun stuff. So check us out. Make sure, if you haven't yet, to buy your tickets for the Majority Report live show at the Wilbur Theater, the Wilba, on January 16th, the big live. We're going to be there, all of us, all four of us, Bradley, Matt, Sam, and myself, and some guests, H. John Benjamin, Larry Murphy, Natalie Scherr, and perhaps some more. So
maybe Clint Schilling. I'm still working on it.
Oh, everybody check
Kurt Schilling.
Kurt Schilling. Clint Schilling. I was like, is that somebody I don't know?
Clint Schilling is like a Nashville baseball player.
Yeah, but Kurt Schilling, we have a good shot at, as well as Big Poppy.
He needs some money, frankly.
And naturally, Gary Busey. All right, Matt, what happened last night on Left Reckoning?
We had a very good conversation.
Besides you missing basketball.
I did. I missed all the basketball last night, which is something that happens, I realized, during Left Reckoning your basketball season. But we had Liza Featherstone in to talk about her piece. She talked about Josh Hawley's sort of appeal to masculinity and how the left should try to address that. And so we cover all sorts of folks from Paul Robeson to Christopher Hitchens and Teddy Roosevelt. So we talked about a full breadth of masculinity last night.
Paul Robeson,
yes.
The bass player or the musician?
He was musical. He was also a dramatic actor and a communist.
Right.
And, really much a Renaissance man.
He wasn't a bass player. Yeah, bass baritone.
So we talked about that last night. And we also talked about the Democrats are being bad and why the PMC party would do something like start student loan debt. Spoiler alert, it's about coercing labor. and you can get a little bit of money out of it. You get austerity, you can address inflation and the quote-unquote worker shortage at the same time without paying people more. And it's, of course, too tempting for a Democrat like Joe Biden to turn down. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get all that. And check it out.
I definitely will check out the Paul Robeson stuff because my grandpa, who was a socialist, used to play me Showboat, like the musical that he was singing in, and would always talk about how much he loved Paul Robeson. And now maybe I understand the political sympathies behind those things.
Oh, yeah. I could recommend you a book on Paul Robeson. He is completely based. Yep.
Yeah. I want to. Now it's all flooding back to me. Haircut Binder and Brandon are here. Hey, guys.
Hi. I didn't get a haircut.
Yeah. Well, no. Binder's the guy today.
Yeah. Haircut Binder. That's the nickname all the people, all the cool kids are calling me nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll just go ahead and start it off here tonight.
What's happening on Doom?
Yeah. Tonight at 9 p.m. over at youtube.com/MattBinder and twitch.tv/MattBinder. On Doomed, Parker Malloy will be joining me to discuss the forever war known as the War on Christmas. Of course, the right-wing manufactured War on Christmas. We'll be diving into the latest on that and the history of it and how the right continues to push it every year for a fun holiday episode of Doomed.
Very nice. Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
We will also be doing an episode, but it will be in counter to Matt's episode about how the War on Christmas is in fact real. Mm-hmm. And it's been being fought for, I want to say, millennia by aliens and Christians and Santas. So look out for that. That's what's going to be our Christmas episode.
Very nice. Warring podcast episodes in the War on Christmas.
I'm trying to have a more optimistic take.
I mean, yeah, I can appreciate that. All right, we are going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920, taking your calls, taking your IMs, having a great time. See you there.
Left is best.
G
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.